So the Dhamma for today is called the Samapatthana, the four right exertions or efforts. Buddha's teaching is obviously something that requires effort. The Buddha said, viriyena dukkha majjeti. Through effort, one overcomes suffering. It's not enough to call yourself a Buddhist or to have faith or confidence in the Buddha. You can't pray to the Buddha, obviously, to become enlightened. Buddhism is something that you have to exert yourself. You have to actually undertake to practice. Too often we see people intellectualizing and studying and philosophizing, even talking about Buddhism, but they will never come to a meditation center to practice. It's a common thing to see people obsessed with study. Or obviously content with worship. So we see people content with chanting, content with prayer and worship and so on. But that's not the way that one properly practices the Buddha's teaching. Obviously, it takes effort, as we can all see through our practice. You have to exert yourself. But there is, of course, wrong exertion. Obviously, exertion in worldly affairs is not considered right exertion in Buddhism. There's nothing evil or sinister about people who exert themselves in their livelihood, obviously. But it's not something that is going to lead you closer to freedom from suffering. At best, it's something that is necessary. As monks, it's necessary for us to exert ourselves in our livelihood to some extent, having to walk on alms round, not having to teach other people when they want, ask for teachings, that sort of thing. For Buddhists and even for Buddhist monks, it can become, it can still arise that one exerts oneself in the wrong way. For example, monks who would exert themselves in cleaning, in maintaining the monastery, even monks who exert themselves in building monasteries. Some monks have become famous in ancient and modern times by wandering and building monasteries and doing a lot of the construction themselves, and they could be praised for their energy, for their effort, their unflagging exertion in building monasteries and jaitiyas and that sort of thing. But obviously none of this is this kind of effort that will lead to freedom from suffering. You could obviously say that it's wholesome. You could clearly see how there's a benefit to building meditation centers and monasteries, but at best, again, it's something that we consider necessary. Not something necessary in a practical sense. Not something that relates to actual practice or freedom from suffering. In meditation as well, it's possible to have the wrong idea. You hear about places, or you see places where they require you to do a certain number of hours of practice a day. We all have experienced this. We've come in contact with this idea of requiring you to do so much practice per day, thinking that the exertion is somehow right exertion, and it's absolutely not. There's nothing great about an excess amount of exertion. Obviously, you could practice too much. In a conventional sense, you could walk too much, you could sit too much. There's a story in Thailand of a monk who sat day and night and apparently became somewhat crippled or invalid as a result of sitting constantly, sitting to meditate, sitting to receive guests, never getting up to walk. He was quite famous, and he was just constantly sitting, and I've heard that apparently his body didn't like that. Obviously, the reason why the Buddha had us do walking and sitting in alternation is for this reason, to give some kind of relief to the body. But here the point is that exerting yourself physically, doing so much walking, so much sitting, is not right effort. It is to be appreciated, certainly, and people can do long hours of practice, but that in and of itself is not right effort. Right effort, according to the Buddha, is these four things. And they all relate to unwholesomeness and wholesomeness. That's where right effort lies. It has to be in the realm of these things. You exert yourself towards wholesomeness and against unwholesomeness in four ways. The first is samvara. Samvara means guarding, and here means guarding against the arising of unwholesomeness, akusala. Number two is bahana. Bahana means removing or abandoning, and here obviously removing or abandoning arisen unwholesomeness. So if it's already arisen, striving, engaging yourself, exerting yourself for the abandoning or for the removal of unwholesomeness. The third is bhavana. Bhavana, we're familiar with this word, it means cultivation or development. Literally, making something be, making something come into being. So striving for the arising of wholesomeness. Bhavana means do what you can to give rise to wholesome qualities. And number four, anurakhana. Rakha, rak in regards to guarding. So anurakhana means guarding or protecting. Guarding or protecting arisen wholesome states. So when you're on a roll, to keep the ball rolling, to keep yourself on the right path and to protect the wholesome qualities, the wholesome habits that you've already cultivated. So quite a simple system, a simple framework, but the important point is that it relates to wholesomeness and unwholesomeness. Exertion is not in terms of, again, how much physical practice you do, but it's about how much mental development and mental improvement you undergo. Now, each of these, you could say, has three levels. As you think of the Buddha's teaching working on three levels. The first level is the conventional or the conceptual level. Well, let's say the worldly or the practical, physical level. The second is the meditative level on a conceptual level, the level of samatha practice. And the third is on the level of vipassana, or ultimate reality. So for example, for samvara, guarding. Guarding on a physical, on a practical, worldly level is actually physically guarding your senses. Not looking at things. When a monk goes on alms round, we actually have rules not to look up, not to look around. Not to look in the eyes. If you're receiving alms from a woman, you're not actually supposed to look at her. This is practical. It's valuable. Obviously, things like more extremes like going to bars or parties, or as monks going to places where we shouldn't go. And being careful when we do go. If you go into the village, to be careful, physically careful. This is valuable. This is a way that we guard from the arising of unwholesomeness. Because obviously, if you don't see something, it can't be triggered. But clearly, just as clearly, this is not the ultimate and most impactful sort of practice. It's not something that's sustainable. And it certainly doesn't stop the arising of unwholesomeness in the mind through imagining. And as they say, you can close your eyes, but you can't close your ears. You can't close your nose, and so on. So there are still, even though you don't look around, you can still hear. Like the story of Chakupala, as you'll learn when we study this in Pali, you'll see there's an element of hearing that leads to great unwholesomeness. So on a deeper level, in the practice of samatha practice, or ordinary meditative practice, guarding is by avoiding, by exerting the mind away from the senses. So instead of paying attention to sights and sounds and smells, you take a single object, for example, a candle flame. And if you focus on the flame and you say to yourself, fire, 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 your mind gets fixated on the element of fire. More common ones in Buddhism are a disc, a white disc, or a disc of earth or something, and you would just say white, white. And you have this concept of white, or the concept of earth, or the concept of fire, anything like that, and it keeps you focused. And as a result, the hindrances can't arise. Unwholesome states of mind can't arise. So this is a more profound and a more sustainable practice, but it's not final, it's not permanent. Of course, obviously, as soon as you stop practicing samatha meditation, you get up and go to for food or traveling, the unwholesomeness can arise again. So the third level is the practice of vipassana. Guarding in terms of vipassana is through seeing clearly, through mindfulness. You're not avoiding the senses. You're not escaping them. Mindfulness, the quality of mindfulness is about facing the experiences. When you face the sights and the sounds, you face the experience of seeing and hearing. When you face it with mindfulness, then the hindrances can't arise because of wisdom, because of full understanding, seeing things clearly as they are. The very same things that would immediately give rise to liking or disliking, or any kind of worry or doubt or any kind of extrapolation, me or mine or anything like that, can't give rise to that. A meditator appreciates this when they focus on, for example, pain, they're feeling the pain in the body and they say to themselves, pain, pain. In the beginning, they can't help but be upset about the pain. But through the cultivation of mindfulness, eventually they'll find that the pain just doesn't arise, the disliking doesn't arise. When they experience the pain, they experience it just as pain. And because of the clarity, there is no disliking of it. For destroying defilements that have already arisen, well, on a physical level, you run away. If you find yourself in a situation where lust has arisen, or greed, or anger has arisen, they tell you just walk away when you're angry at someone. This is good advice. It's advice that as Buddhists we really should take. It's the first defense. Before anything else, get yourself in a situation where you don't have to face extreme triggers, where you're not likely to get really angry or really greedy or lustful or so on. So it's valuable to leave. The Buddha even said you should leave if a place is not giving you good concentration. If you're in a place where there's real hindrances, like maybe you're not getting along with the other monks or that sort of thing. You shouldn't run away from all situations, but certainly this is a valuable advice on a very superficial level. What you do find is people are constantly running away, where they rather than actually do anything deeper, anything more meaningful, they're just constantly trying to escape their problems, and that's obviously not sustainable. On a temporary on a very superficial level, it can be beneficial, but you have to go deeper if you want to put it to good use. once you've retreated, then take the time to get stronger so that in the future, obviously, you don't have to retreat. On a deeper level, in the practice of samatha, the eradication of defilements is undertaken not just by ignoring, but also by replacing. So in the practice of samatha, we talk about replacing anger with love, for example. So when a person practices metta, this can be very helpful when anger has already arisen. You can try to change your state of mind, change your attitude, change your opinion of someone. When a person has lust arise, they're instructed to do mindfulness of the parts of the body, the loathsome aspects of the body. This is called the replacement with opposites, and it's a part of the cultivation of samatha practice. And this can be very effective. This even is a practice, as a practitioner of vipassana, we undertake from time to time. You can find it valuable and helpful when the emotions are too strong. That's why these sorts of meditations are called araka kamatana. They guard the meditator. There's something that you can undertake anytime. Mindfulness of the Buddha, when you have great doubt, you're doubting what you're doing, doubting your ability to do it, think of the Buddha and it gives you encouragement. That sort of thing. For the practice of vipassana, the eradication of unwholesomeness comes from facing the unwholesomeness and seeing it clearly. So for the unwholesomeness not to arise, you pay attention to the experiences, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. When you face the seeing, the defilements can arise. But in mindfulness practice, the Buddha instructed us even to face the hindrances. When the hindrances arise, you don't try to repress them or destroy them, you face them. And you're not actually destroying the defilements, obviously, because you're observing them, you're letting them persist. And so it seems like in some ways this is wrong practice. People can be discouraged by this, thinking, what, won't that just make me more angry? And that's the truth, is that it won't. The truth and the ultimate reality is that greed, anger, and delusion, like everything else, arise only momentarily. And any moment that you change your attitude from disliking something to seeing it clearly, the chain breaks. So with vipassana practice, because you're dealing on an ultimate level, or a level of ultimate reality, you're breaking the chain rather than destroying. Because in ultimate reality, in truth, you can't destroy anything. Reality arises and ceases in moments, and those moments are not under our control. You can't make them cease. All you can do in any of these levels, any of these practices, is break the chain. And so you see that on an ultimate level. That rather than try in some way to control, to be in charge, to have some kind of self, you just change the attitude, and instead of reacting, you just engage in understanding. This is pahana, this is for destroying or abandoning. For bhavana, for cultivating, as far as cultivating wholesomeness, on a conventional level, a worldly level, we engage in good deeds. And this is why we talk about the punya kriya vatu. A person is charitable, a person is ethical or moral, and even the practice of ordinary meditation practice. When you undertake these practices, the physical act of walking and sitting is something that is quite valuable in and of itself. But you have to separate that from actual meditation. Even just walking back and forth, what we call bhavana, in and of itself, the walking or even the sitting still is not the development of wholesomeness. So these things are conventional and worldly and superficial. Dana, for example, when you give charity, well, you think, well, that's a good deed, but not always. Yes, usually it is, but not necessarily. A person can give out of ego. A person can be worried when they're giving. Is this right? Am I doing this right? Is this good to give? If you give to a beggar, maybe you're thinking, what will he do with it? What will they do with it? Will they maybe buy drugs or alcohol with it? Do they really need it? You can give rise to great unwholesomeness. It's a part of the training in regards to charity. Charity is not as easy as it may seem. It's not just about giving, it's about having a wholesome state of mind. So on a superficial level, these acts that we do, even acts of keeping ethical precepts, a person can want to kill or want to hurt and stop themselves, but it doesn't stop the unwholesomeness in the mind. And the same with bhavana. Just sitting for hours or walking for hours is not the cultivation of wholesomeness. But all three of these things obviously are a part of our practice. We should be charitable because, again, it's training you on deeper level. You should be ethical because it helps your training. You should walk and you should sit. A person who says, I'm not going to do formal meditation, I'm just going to be mindfulness, is most likely going to fail. Is most likely deluding themselves. The formal walking and the formal sitting is crucial in actually being able to develop wholesome states. But on a deeper level, we have the practice of samatha and the practice of vipassana. With the practice of samatha, you're cultivating the five faculties. You're cultivating all sorts of good states. The only thing that you're lacking in the practice of samatha, because you're focusing on a concept like fire or a light or a color or something like that, is wisdom. And so you're developing good states, you're developing a lot of very wholesome states, confidence, effort, mindfulness, concentration, even wisdom in the sense of the understanding of the mind and the wisdom to see the difference between right and wrong. You're just not developing wisdom on a level of seeing the three characteristics or the Four Noble Truths. And so on the deepest level, on the practice of vipassana, because you're paying attention to momentary experiences as they arise and cease, you're also developing wisdom. And this is the greatest development of wholesomeness. I think it's in the commentaries it says, when you talk about wholesomeness, you can't really talk about wholesomeness without talking about mindfulness. It might have been the Buddha, I'm not sure, but the teaching is that mindfulness is the greatest sort of wholesomeness. Or you can't talk about wholesomeness without mindfulness. And that's mostly true with the practice of vipassana, when you focus on ultimate reality. Because you do see the three characteristics and you give up craving and clinging, and it's the greatest sort of exertion when you exert yourself in this practice. Because it leads to nibbana, it leads to the greatest goodness. And then finally for anurakhana, how you guard your wholesomeness. This is perhaps the most interesting or of greatest interest to us, because we want to reach some kind of goal, we want to reach a state. Any meditator, even a new meditator, will tell you that they're feeling the need or the drive to reach a meditative state. And so this is a way of expressing the idea of getting to a state where you're good at the meditation, where you can guard it, where you're able to protect it, anurakhana. So on a material level, we guard or we protect the practice physically by seclusion, by not living in society, by not living amongst people who are engaged in sensuality, by not connecting with the world. We seclude ourselves even from the senses, sights and sounds and smells, tastes, even thoughts. Don't read or study too much outside of the Buddhist teaching, that sort of thing. But we guard in this way, it can be very valuable. It limits the diversity of perceptions, it limits the amount of triggering that goes on where you're triggered into greed or anger or delusion. And it allows you to protect the wholesome qualities that you develop through meditation practice. Through samatha practice, the guarding goes on through continuation. The thing about samatha practice is it's something that you have to keep up. It requires upkeep. As I said, anytime you stop practicing, you can easily fall back to your old habits because of the lack of wisdom. And so the value of samatha is that you can continue to practice, but the shortcoming, the limit to it is that you have to keep practicing. And samatha, the qualities, the purity of mind, which is very real purity, is temporary and is only dependent. It's dependent on the exertion. Now the exertion with guarding in vipassana exists as well. For a person continuing on the path, they do have to protect their progress just as a person practicing samatha. However, the difference is obviously that a person who has practiced well, practiced properly, the practice of vipassana meditation, comes to a point where they do not fall back, where they are not subjected to the degradation of their quality, of their wholesomeness of mind. An enlightened person needs exert no effort, no special effort to maintain their state. However, it shows you quite clearly the difference or the nature of true and supreme effort or exertion, in that an arahant, an enlightened being, is constantly energetic. They have no flagging of energy. They need not exert themselves, and yet they are constantly energetic. They're constantly engaged in activities that are pure, activities of body, of speech, and of mind that are pure. So ultimately, when we look at what is true effort or true exertion, in a way it's effortless. It doesn't take any special exertion. And in some ways, this is a lesson for us, even as beginners, that it's not about exerting yourself. It's about directing yourself. It's about changing your perspective. And when you come to the state of true and proper exertion, you're not actually exerting yourself at all. You're just perfectly energetic, and your energy is perfect, along with all the other faculties. Nonetheless, or regardless, our practice involves this very clear and instructive framework for the cultivation of effort. That as meditators, we have to think of all four of these. We have to think about guarding against the arising of unwholesomeness. We have to think about unwholesomeness that has arisen and how we are going to free ourselves from it when it arises. We have to think about the cultivation of wholesomeness. Think about the wholesome states that we need or that will support us, and what we can do to cultivate them, and how we can guard them once they have arisen. These are the four right exertions, an important part of our practice, and that's the Dhamma for today.